Into the final moments, Alex Payne trying to keep this side going forward. Haskell takes it on now with just relentless chat, largely about himself. And there's Tindall to add the finishing touch of glamour and World Cup winning stories and a slightly sideways nose. That is how you podcast. A dominant display by the good, the bad and the rugby.
Hello and welcome to The Good, The Bad and The Rugby, brought to you by Continental Tires. Yes, this is not Alex's voice. It's a very foreign accent if you're not used to it. I know, it takes a lot to get used to. It's my pleasure to step in this week and be joined by Bob Skinsella. It's a little reunion. The last time I saw you, the Springboks went on to beat the All Blacks in a very triumphant fashion at Twickenham, and you saw it all coming.
Well, I don't know if I saw it all coming, but I certainly was confident and excited. It was all pre-tournament, and it was, I think it was a celebration. It was still warm enough for us South Africans to feel our fingers and our toes. so it was a good time. It was certainly a good weekend and some interesting rugby that started to be played even then.
Well, the boys, Payne, Hask and Tins, they're all off on the hollybobs, as they say around here. It's a word I've learned recently. And, well, the Southern Hemisphere rights are in the building in a big way. And we are joined by someone in another building with heating, we hope, for his sake. The two-time Rugby World Cup winner, the brand new man in charge at Leinster. He's a bit like the Heston Blumenthal of rugby coaches, a bit like Q. He likes a gadget or two. He's always cooking away at some interesting solutions and innovative new ways of doing things. Jock Nienaber, how's Dublin tonight?
Good day. Ach ja, good evening, the two of you. Now, Dublin is nice and chilly. Definitely different than a 30-degree Cape Town, that I can tell you.
Jock, I've got to say, I mean, you've been around the country celebrating, and it looked like in a very joyous fashion. Have the Irish embraced that and nestled you in for a cold Guinness to celebrate the end of the World Cup, or is that still are you still breaking some new relationships there?
No, Bob. I must say the people here, you know, the Irish, they are phenomenal people enough, and luckily I had this stint with Rassie in 2016-17, you know, so we're quite familiar with the culture over here now, so I've had some good pints already. Everybody is, you must go to this one, you must go to this pub, that pub is a good guinea, so I've had a few good guineas this year. Yeah.
But since the end of October, you could honestly not have stopped yet, because you've gone from the frying pan into the fire, it seems. A great big celebration tour in South Africa, a few days off, straight into Dublin and the pub scene.
Yeah, no, it's been busy over there. Obviously, after the World Cup, I was in a there was a handover, obviously, between myself and Saru, in terms of the IP and all that stuff, and some commitments with sponsors and talks and stuff that I had to do. And then as soon as that was done, I was keen to get over to this side, you know, and I think it's going to be a nice challenge with Leinster, and I know it's going to take some time for me to settle in. So it did way back with Munster, and when I went back to South Africa, it took some time to get settled and to get into the way of how we want to do things and the defense, and it takes time to adjust to it. So I thought rather earlier than later.
So now just give us an idea of how much moving has had to happen. Are the kids there? Did the pets come with? Have you moved pot plants, the whole caboodle, or was it just you in a suitcase?
Well, initially it was just me in a suitcase. So I arrived here the day of the Munster game, a Munster-Leinster game. So I missed that game. I was on the flight. And then I started the week of connect with the team, just getting to know everyone. My wife arrived the Wednesday or the Thursday of that connect week, and the kids the week after. So they were finishing up the exams and stuff like that. But the whole family is here. The dog came first. So the dog is with me, yeah. So in our family, the pecking order is the dog, then the children, and then probably me. But at least I've got a friend. I've got a friend, yeah. So it's not alone.
One more than zero, which is great. Almery obviously runs a really tight ship there. The dog's travel was booked alongside everyone else's. As someone who has moved pets across hemispheres, I can highly recommend doing it, but also finding someone else to help you with it, because it is a dizzying amount of admin. Back to the rugby. Speaking of dizzying amount of rugby and admin, after you win a Rugby World Cup, how does that work? You've now done it twice, so you could probably write the book on it.
Obviously, the game was the Saturday.
Yeah.
Then the Sunday was almost the Rugby Awards was that evening.
Mm.
So a couple of beers during the day, and with the World Cup and the families and all that that happened on the Sunday, and then the Sunday evening the Rugby Awards, and we flew out the next day, in different groups. So. It depends on how, because obviously World Rugby doesn't know who's going to play in the final and who's going to be in the last on the last flights out of the hosting country. So in Japan the team was split up in probably 5 or 6 or 7 different flights. But this time around the team went with one flight, and then the management went with another one, and then you arrive and it's chaos. It's Oor Tambo full of people. And phenomenal, the energy that we got from the people when we arrived back in South Africa. And then it's trophy tour and sponsors and you pay back basically because the World Cup actually belongs to them. So you pay it back as much as you can, and it's quite busy, and you stand on a bus and you wave and you give energy, and it's amazing to see the people next to the side of the road and running with a bus, and even the people or the families that were with us on the bus. As you see the people and the excitement in the people and how emotional the people are, it gets to you. A lot of the family members that were on the bus started crying, because you can't explain it, but it's this unbelievably humbling experience, and it's very emotional actually.
Why do you think that is? Why was there such an outpouring of energy and emotion aimed at the Springboks, especially this time around?
I don't know. I think in 2019, I think people, there was hope that we would have been successful. But I think this time around, there was a lot of expectation, especially on the players. There was a lot of, I mean, you've won it last time, and you only lost two players. You only lost Beast and Francholo and Skull Brits that actually didn't continue playing rugby. So the whole team that won it in 2019 was available again. So I think there was a lot of expectations on the players and from the fans. And then obviously I think the 1 point wins in the quarter, semis and final didn't do that. It created there was a lot of tension, and if I can put it like that, I think there was a lot of tension and emotion in the fans. And then obviously and with expectations, and I think when the team delivered, I think the people was just crazy. They were absolutely crazy, the fans.
Certainly was amazing. I mean, my family, Jacques, as you know, we all come from passionate rugby households, you know, and I from Omar, my mum, to my wife, to my little son, and I was just commentating, and I was kept coming back to the UK on a Eurostar early on a Monday morning, and they'd still be emotional and cross with me because we'd made them so emotional for the day. You know, I can imagine it's times 10,000 for you, but it certainly was one of the things that carried it for the length of the tournament. You're right, was how close and how emotionally charged those games were.
Which one was the worst for you? Because I definitely think the English one was the worst for me. As a fan, that game was torture. I mean, all three of them were a lot. But that one was... Bob, which one was the toughest
one? I'm just thinking through that now and recalling all three. I mean, I think the England game definitely, we're a commentary panel and we're close friends and we're competitive and that kind of thing. But definitely in that environment was incredibly emotionally charged as well.
I found the French 1 point win really exciting, really fun, really like there was invigorating speed and really exhilarating. And most people who watched that went, geez, what a game that was. But the England one felt like a lot of really hard work watching on. The final, I feel like I anticipated it almost. Maybe we'd gone through 2 weeks of that and we'd kind of been preparing ourselves for more of the same. But I'm always fascinated by how you guys reflect on it once you've had a few weeks to get over the intense stress and probably the exhaustion of it all.
No, definitely, Elmer, definitely the England game. Yes, that semi-final. I'll tell you, I think the French game was it was a beautiful evening. So the stage was laid to have a crack at each other with ball in hand. So they scored 3 tries, we scored 4 tries, 7 tries was scored in that quarterfinal. So and so the game was set up for a thriller. And I think even the quarterfinal against Ireland, New Zealand was also a thriller. But then for the semi-final, we actually... In the week when we looked at the weather, it showed that there was rain coming, but it was only going to hit us probably in the last 10 or 15 minutes of the game. That's what we thought was going to happen on the Monday when we start preparing for that for that semi-final. But then, yes, the rain came through a lot quicker. So we actually wanted to play a more expansive game against England, if I can say it like that. If you think what we did in 2022, when we played them at Twickenham, so Curtly Arden's try, so there was a lot more. We used the ball a lot more, but then with the rain, we had to change our strategy and our plans, obviously, or in the game.
Jacques, you even started like that because you had those long wide passes. In the first 3-4 minutes, and then suddenly you'd done that twice, and the rain came down.
And it was just like
so you almost had to shut up shop.
Yeah, and that's why that was a stressful thing because we felt that we struggled even in the 2019 final. We struggled to get our balls going against England, so we had to revert back to that. So things in that game we had to find solutions on the run, and that's why that was such a stressful game for us, for me personally. I mean, if you think about it, we had to make a substitution with Marnie early on. It was raining. It wasn't probably, I won't say it doesn't suit him and he can't play in the rain, but Andre playing his rugby and applying his trade in the north, he's a lot more used to the circumstances. So that was quite emotional and a big call that we had to make early on in the game, which is not always nice. You have to put the team first and so that was by far the most stressful one. The final's always going to be, I mean, even in the 2019 final, if you look at the end score, it looks big, you know, but half time we went in, it was 12-6 at one stage. I think it was 18-12 and then we scored a try. So we actually only got control, I would say, in the 2019 game. We only got control probably from minute 65 onwards when my pimp scored. That's when we got a little bit of control and breathing space. And then obviously England, the time was running out. They had to chase the game, which gave us another opportunity to score. But luckily it worked out at the end of the day.
Yeah, now we can smile about it, but it was nothing to smile about in the moment.
No.
I want to go back to that decision about sending on Andre and Marnie, but also there were so many other really big moments at this tournament. Your biggest intervention, the biggest decision that now in hindsight you can look back on and go, I'm glad I took this decision. And we'd obviously like a look behind the scenes. So I don't know how many of those decisions were 50% Rassie and 50% Jacques either. But we'd love to hear your personal take on a moment where you went, this is what we're going to do now. And it either worked or it helped set things in motion.
Yeah, I think in terms of decisions made, we always like... we are a very transparent coaching group, so we get everybody's input, and that's why I think it was in the England game where we all huddled around Rassie was sitting on the edge, so we got so myself and Rassie is in communication with each other, and then next to me is Felix who ran the attack, and then we've got Dan and Dion and them sitting in the front, so we had to make changes because we couldn't get our foothold in that game, so everybody in, and because now are we going to bring Quagga on, okay, but will the lineouts function, so Dion had to give input in that, will the scrums function, so that I would say the decision making is always a collective in terms let's say we bring Andre on Stocker, will you be happy with the kicking game, how will that affect you, and so the decision making I would say is a group.
When I speak to people about you and Rassie, one of the first things that people always ask is when did they start working together? Where did this come from? Because for the rest of the Northern Hemisphere, it feels like this revolution in South African rugby happened overnight. At one point, we were losing to Italy, and the next thing, these two guys are on the scene, and here they are just absolutely cruising, and the plane's taking off. But obviously, no success happens overnight, and no partnership like this was forged in the last 2 years. And then when I say, I heard a story that the two of you met back in 1991 on a military base in Bloemfontein, which is the least fancy place I can probably imagine in the entire world, because I lived next door to that military base when I was a child. It's such a long journey that you have been on, and whereas Rassie, as a former Springbok and a player who's represented his country at the highest level, could probably have foreseen some sort of version of this future in his wildest dreams. Take me back to whether the Jacques Nienaber in 1991 would have ever foreseen this journey and this road and these high moments in his life.
No, never. Yes, in 1991. We met in the army. So we both were in the School of Armor together. So I was in one, we weren't in the same battalion, but I was in one Special Services battalion, and Rassie was in the School of Armor. But we had a mutual friend, so a guy that was friends with me at school, he was Rassie's roommate. So that's how I met Rassie the first time, was in the army. And then obviously I went, Rassie stayed a little bit on in the army. I went and studied, became a physio, and then when Rassie started playing for the Shimlas, I was the Shimlas' physio. So that's where we actually joined up again. He as a player and myself as a physio. And then obviously started working together from a coaching perspective was in 2005 when Rassie took over head coach of the Cheetahs from Piet Kleinhans. I was the SNC, I was a physio then and transitioning into strength and conditioning because Derek Kutsio was the strength and conditioning coach at the Cheetahs back then. He then joined Jake White with a Springbok. So there was like this void there, and we couldn't, Rassie felt that he couldn't get the right guy, so he asked me if I would go over to that side of things. So I did a little bit of study in that, and then I went into SNC. So that's where we started working together. So from a management point of view, from 2005, so it's, we almost 30 years, know each other for 30 years, working together on a management level from 2005. And obviously my roles have changed. I was first a physio, then SNC, and then assistant coach, and then head coach. But no, I never foreseen this. I in my mind, just being a physio with a sports team was my wildest dream, if I can put it like that, and just to be with a physio for the Cheetahs would have been good for me, you know. So I never in my wildest dreams thought that that things would turn out like they turned out. I had an unbelievable ride thus far. I hope I can get another couple of years of that.
There certainly will be lots more. Jacques, so I'm not going to let you get away with only that, because what he doesn't tell you is that he was the hardest working physio you've ever seen in your entire life, because I was a guy who rugby was interesting but not all absorbing for me. So I would go and sit with the physios when Jacques was the head physio at the Cats and listen, because up until 12 o'clock midnight, he'd be literally looking after players. I remember Marco Wenzel came there and chatted the backside of everybody. He could talk more than anyone else, and then you used to roll your eyes, but still, because you were working on the other players, we'd be talking. And I think that ingrained love of the game and the players, etc. That year, Russi, did he hurt his Achilles, Jacques? I think he hurt his Achilles or calf or something like that.
Yeah.
Oh, it was his foot. That's right. It was something
that stopped him playing.
That stopped him playing.
Yeah, his foot.
It was the last season, and he started with the Cats and tried and went through the preseason, and then wasn't able to make it, and then he got the job to go across to the Cheetahs at that stage, and sort of almost transitioned straight away. And it didn't take him long to have signalling on the roof, and that's come a long way as well. But I mean, what an amazing ode to the relationship between them, you know?
Yeah, those lights on the roof that everyone who knew watched.
Those were the aeroplane signal batons, and now it's moved to the lights. I love it.
I love that. Yeah. But so the fact that you went to the military is a really interesting one for me, because you were a pretty promising athlete at school, played a bit of rugby, went to Grey College, which is a Springbok factory, didn't become a Springbok or play high-level rugby yourself. You could have had, and I was explaining this to our producer, Tom Edwards, in the South African context, if you're a physiotherapist, you could have a very comfortable, very quiet, but very well set up life. And you could dabble with, you know, being the Cheetahs physiotherapist here and there if rugby really gave you a thrill. But there is a version of your life that could have gone very quietly and under the radar, and you could have had all the bottles of red wine that you would have loved in your life. And no one would have ever stopped you on the street or tell your kids what they thought of how you do your job or invade your privacy in the way that South Africans do, because now we own you. This is a very prominent position to be in, and it must have been a journey that in the beginning you were probably not completely sure of. Was there a point at any point where you looked at this and went, it's actually asking quite a bit from me. There is this whole other parallel existence I could have that could have been nice and quiet.
When I started going into the coaching side of things, I did the physio side and the S&C side, I really enjoyed that. I really enjoyed working with the players and working with the players on the field. I really enjoy that. I love coaching. It gives you a buzz like nothing else. And when Russi actually suggested that I go over and started maybe defense coach, I mean, the transition sounds now crazy. I mean, how do you go from physiotherapy to defense coach? But way back in those days, there wasn't defense coaches. I'm talking now 2004, 2005. There was defense coaches in league. Yeah, Bob, and they started moving into rugby. But the transition was easy. I could say anything to the players because they didn't have a backdrop of a defense coach at school that would challenge you. They were just doing well. So there was this blank canvas. So that's how I got into the coaching. Yes, but I enjoyed that. I enjoyed the tactical part of things. I love the chess game in it. You were asking from a parallel point of view, or would I didn't envision that it would become like this. And I must say the assistant coach part is awesome, because the head coach part was something that I had to get used to, and you would know. I mean, we spoke about it when the British and Irish Lions series, it was something for me to get used to, especially the media and all that. I loved being private and on to work with the players and be there in the cold face of winning or losing a game, but you're not in the public, so but And I guess you get used to that. I won't say I'm good at it, but I got more used to it at the end. But your question is, do I sometimes think I could have had it and a lot more safer? I wouldn't want it different, Elmer. Yes, I enjoy a challenge. I really, really enjoy a challenge. And that's why I think probably physio was awesome. But then when the challenge came, listen, you can, what about strength and conditioning? I like to challenge myself with something new, you know. And then the defense stuff, Jock, are you keen to try and go into a defense coaching role? Yes, I will grab it with both hands. So I think that's just my personality. I like the challenge, and to see if you can not master it, but if you can, I like the challenge. I like the not getting used to and settled in.
Jacques, there was so to segue on to something else we want to talk about, but you mentioned the league coaches coming across, and I'm thinking off the top of my head, Andy Farrell, in terms of a guy who played league, he also played union, yeah. But understanding the league coaching, Les Kiss is another one, David Nisifora,
yeah.
And we've seen them have fantastic roles around rugby union. Coaches have moved around. Now there's a big question, are players going to be more allowed to move around? You are seeing probably now for the first time at the coalface, URC rugby at the provincial level, because you've, you know, for the last 8 years or 7 years, you've been one level above that. South African players being allowed to move around, do you think that's going to be healthier for our game? And is there a way we can manage it that benefits everybody?
I think for South Africa, I'm not sure, I can't talk for other unions and other countries, but for us, I just think to allow our players to play abroad and then still select them. Is that what you mean? Still select
that
them
sort of
for
thing.
The
I'm saying, is it something that you believe that should be good for them to still be selected for Springboks?
Yeah, I think so, Bob. Because I don't think we have the currency to pay up. We have the monetary strength to pay our players the value that they are valued at. You know, so from a monetary point of view, and I think if you look at the squad that we took, I think it's half about 16, let's say 15 or 16 of the players are applying their trade abroad, and 15, 16 apply their trade in South Africa, and those guys that play abroad, I don't know what their salary bill is, but I mean, if they were in South Africa, there's no way we would have been able to pay them, but I do think it's good for us that they go abroad, they play there, and then you can still select them if they're good enough and if they're relevant enough. You can still select them for South Africa. I think that really helped us win two World Cups. It works for us. Because if you think about it, if you just think at locks, so we had RG, the locks that played in the World Cup. So Eben is with the Sharks, but he was also abroad in 2019. Then you have Franco Mostert, who's abroad. You have Ergio, who was abroad. John Klein, who's abroad. Marvin Ori was at home, or he played with the Stormers. So, but if all of them stayed in South Africa, I think they wouldn't have been the Norkiers and the young guys coming through now
point,
because they would have been blocked by them. So then moving on, you can now in the URC, you get the new guys that are playing in the URC. So you actually, where you maybe would have had, two or three per union and you have the four URC teams, you would have had only half of the amount of locks that are currently that you can select or
to choose from,
just because guys are so it broadens your guys exposure to top rugby so I think it's a good thing for us.
In anything that you do or that South Africa does gets judged as an unfair advantage from the outside in, but from the inside out, I have to say, as a South African, you know, with currency measures and all those kind of things, it's amazing to be able to see so many young players come through either their local provinces or be able to ply their trade internationally. And we've even had a couple of players who have made peace with the fact that, you know, 4 years in a foreign country and they're probably not going to get a chance to go back, and they can't upstage another player in their position, but they're good enough to play rugby internationally, and they make a different pathway for themselves, and that's a positive. It's got to be a positive.
I think that if I can, in my professional career, go and ply my trade, as I've done, in a different geological location, because there is a different opportunity there that'll challenge and grow and encourage me to test myself, and that's socially acceptable. I feel like as a professional athlete, you should be given every opportunity to go test, learn, develop, experience, and also just grow as a person, because there's so much of that growth that happens when you're taken outside of your safe little space, in other environments, learning other languages, but also just experiencing other cultures firsthand. And this is a really contentious issue, but from a coaching perspective, what makes it harder when half your crop applying their trade overseas? Is there, it's more of a headache getting them released, getting them available, getting them free at all of the right times. But are there other complications here that we're being naive to?
No, definitely. The challenge is alignment, because it's easy to keep them aligned with the Springbok way, because obviously now they play in Japan, and the Japan League, there's not a big kicking game there. And so they've got different skill sets that get developed in different competitions, but to still then keep them aligned with the way we're going to, our DNA, the way we're going to do it in South Africa, that's a tough part. That's why we had a lot of alignment camps. So we would have online alignment camps with players regularly, just to keep them aligned with. Remember, Faf, you're playing in Japan. I know it's a ball, it's a more ball in hand approach, but you must still continue to practice your box kicks, because remember, in our system, we're probably going to look at attacking teams aerially as well. So the alignment is the first part, and then I would say the second part is the player management, because it's and we find it tough now with our URC players as well, where you play your competition in the Northern Hemisphere, but your club competition, but your test matches or your is still in the Southern Hemisphere, yes. Calendar. So that makes it tough. What we can do is we can manage the players in South Africa. We can manage their load, and like we did, we took them out of rugby in the Six Nations for a reconditioning block, because otherwise they would have just played and played and played. And that is the bad thing with the players who plays abroad. They don't get managed. They just play and play and play. And I think that's why a lot of players are currently going to the Japan, because the Japan season is a lot more aligned with the South African international season. There's a lot more flexibility there. But definitely France, and the challenges are France and the UK or the Premiership. That's the big challenge, and managing the players and the players' loads. But I must say, that's why I did a lot of visits at the clubs with Andy Edwards, who's the head of our athletic performance, and with Felix. So that's why Felix Jones were based in Dublin. He serviced the players that were playing here in the in Europe, in the Northern Hemisphere. I can't comment on other countries and other unions, how they manage that, but definitely for us, with our currency and with the amount of youngsters that gets produced and gets spit out into the system, I think it's good for us not to block them. It's good for, so if clubs or the clubs abroad wants to use some of our players, it opens up a hole for that I always want to say that factory machine that produces these youngsters, so they can get exposure nice and early in their careers.
In terms of the management, though, when you do make big decisions like the one you mentioned, pulling Marnie and sending Handre on in a crucial point, managing that fallout within a team in such a tense week, in such a tense build-up in a Rugby World Cup knockout phase, the culture needs to be so incredibly strong to sustain big decisions like that, because we've all got friends at work that we get along with really well. And then when your friend gets hauled over the coals or doesn't get the opportunity that you think they deserve, then your lip's also a bit long and you're a little like itchy for them as well. Talk to me about that culture that you guys have managed to build. And you built a really good culture in a very short amount of time between that loss to Italy, what was that, 2016, 2017. The turnaround to 2019, I saw it firsthand because I was often embedded reporting on the Springboks. I was there. I remember the day when you guys announced Sia as captain. And I could genuinely see the needle move there, you know, the energy, the warmth, the positivity with which people came to every engagement and every training session. How? What is the secret to fostering that? And I'm sure there isn't just one thing, but if there is one thing that now that you're in a new environment that you need to bed in again from scratch, because this time around, it's you bringing the Jock Nienaber way of doing things to Leinster. Talk to me about what the ways are in which you embed culture first and foremost.
Yes, Elma, I think the most important thing is to get the right people, not necessarily the best. Because and that's sometimes where we do, when we do select the squad, sometimes we don't select, there's probably, I would say, better players that are better than the ones we select in our squad, that are performing better. But the key thing is they must be the right people for the environment, for the way we do things. And that's why sometimes we get criticized selecting a squad. And yes, but this guy is on form and he's by far better than that guy. And you know what? The public are knowledgeable in South Africa. They are completely right. But sometimes that guy's not the right guy. And I think that even if you think about what happened, so if the quarterfinal, Marnie and Kobus Reinach, they started, you know, and we beat France in France at home, which was a massive, it was a massive win that. And then the two of them again played in the semi-final, you know, and Kobus, and then for the final, just because of our analysis and what the team that we went with, a 7-1 split, which then obviously somebody is going to fall out, and then selecting Faf for the final. It's not that Kobus wasn't good enough to play in the final and win a final for us, but we just felt as a management that Faf is the right guy for that specific game, like Kobus was the right guy for the French game, and Kobus was the right guy for the game against England. We felt Faf was the right guy. Doesn't mean that Kobus were better than Faf or Faf is better than Kobus. It is who's the right personnel for that specific game. And to do that, the players must trust you. And that, for that, you must have the right players. And I must say, that's the nice thing. The players, I felt the players trusted us and the decisions you made. And we also trusted them, you know. So, and I think that's the key thing. You must have the right people. They're not necessarily the best, but they're the right people. So I would say that's the most important part in terms of the culture. If you have the right people there, I mean, everybody go, like you say, everybody, it's not nice. I mean, it is horrible for Kobus not playing in the World Cup final, you know, because he played in the other two and he was good enough to play in the World Cup final. But we just felt Faf was the right decision for that specific game. And then even we are family friendly in our environment. So we had, I think we had 65 women and or partners and kids in the last 2 weeks of the final that stayed in the hotel with us. So it was like a crash. It was chaos. It was brilliant. I loved it. And even, you know, sometimes when let's say Manay, who's Faf's partner, when Kobus gets selected, Manay can be, sometimes you can find that the partners can become grumpy and why is my husband not? And there was nothing of that. The partners were incredible, you know. There was never a bitching between them, and they just pick up the pieces. So when we don't select Faf for a game, or we don't select Kobus, then their partners just pick up the pieces, glue them back together again. And so I know we have that hashtag of stronger together, but I really felt in this World Cup, from the kids, the partners, I mean, how many pictures, how many times have you seen Vinny carrying around Bongi's kids and Bongi carrying around Vinny's kids, you know? So everybody was invested in everybody. It was this massive big family. We had the right people and the players were the players and their partners were the right people for the squad.
Jacques, I think and that's part of the kudos. I mean, I haven't had a chance to say it to you personally, but it's a fantastic display of empathetic leadership from you guys and a buy-in from all the teams. And actually great to see that from a national team with leaders of men and leaders of families and leaders of countries, sports teams actually displaying, you know, that kind of interaction. And it was something that really stood out. You know, you could see it. I had a slightly more trained eye. I was delighted with that, and I think it gave an incredible message. I had a slightly more trained eye on the decisions on the field, because you made some big decisions around players of unbelievable international caliber at crucial times of a match, where even as a commentator, I'm looking around the stadium and people going, oh, why is he taking that guy off? Or why? And I know some of the backstory, but I'd love to hear just from you. You know, culturally, in terms of the team, I didn't see one rolling eye. I didn't see one shaking head. I didn't see one type display. You know, and people forget how quickly, because we get accustomed here. I watch Premiership football and international football, and it's amazing. But you get a guy completely avoiding his coach, walking off, kicking a water bottle, shaking his head or whatever. Mm. You know, I'm sure you'd be delighted if Ibn Etzebeth avoided you if you had to shepherd's hook him off the field. But culturally, it felt for me that almost any decision made in those 85-odd minutes or crucial 85-odd minutes would just be listened to with no argument, because that was pre-agreed. Is that the environment you were trying to get for the performance zone?
Yeah, we would. So our team selections and team discussions were always done open, so everybody could hear. So when we select or announce a team, we would announce a team and we would say, listen, this is the reasons why we selected the team like this. There wasn't any one-on-ones, no one-on-ones. So it was done, if the player wanted a one-on-one and a discussion afterwards, we were open to that. But it was never before team selection. We had one-on-ones with players and the team got announced on Monday morning. That's the first thing we do normally, or day one. We would announce the squad, but it was announced in front of everyone. So and we would explain our thought process and we would say we are not sure here. We went with this and this is our gut feel, but we discussed this option and this option and this option. So I think we were open and honest from the start when it came to team selection, and then obviously that feeds into the Saturday, the match, that the players knew that. And I think we were lucky, Bob, that there wasn't a big gap between the players. So if a player was on the bench, it wasn't necessarily that he's second best, you know.
Of course,
and I think that makes makes it easy,
which is hard to explain. I've got to say I'm lucky enough to have played the game, not to the level of what these guys are playing in the modern day, but you can get it after a while. You can see what you guys are doing. You know, you might start with a guy who only does 15 or 18 or 23 hard minutes of something because actually there's a bigger plan, you know, whereas the public gets used to, you know, we do our 60 minutes and then the reserves come on, or if there's an injury, then they come on. And the beauty for me was your guys' display of attitude and aptitude. It was an ability to put the right guys in the right positions. And to do that, you've got to move those pieces around the chess table without them getting cross with you and having a display that affects the culture in the team. So I found that was extraordinary. Well done on that front. I think Elmer's is going to be cross with me, but I want to do two or three quick questions. You're allowed to think, but you're not allowed to go with like a long answer, because I don't want to get you in trouble. Whose idea was Damian Willems' scrum decision?
Oh, please, come on. Give us that.
France, a quick one. It was, I would say, Rassie.
Okay. One word answer.
Okay. And then the decisions about you know, moving players around, etc. How many times did you either have to convince Rassie of your idea, or did he have to convince you of his idea, or is that a thing born in the management team?
Probably born in the management team, but I would say so like the 7-1 split in the final, probably started myself and Rassie had a conversation, and we were keen for 7-1. Then we presented to the management, and then from the management it went to some of them were 5-3 and keep it the same as what we did in the quarters and the semis. And then Rassie was at one stage at a 6-2 again, and then I was in a 7-1 again. So it's like that. That's the conversation. But the one thing I can say is that when we decide as a management, okay, listen, we're gonna go this route. We're gonna go with a 7-1 in the World Cup final, and we're not gonna have a scrum off on the bench, and Cheslin will cover scrum off. And some guys will be opposed to that, some guys won't. And then we will explain, show clips and discuss. And it's a long process. It's a long process. But once we decide that's the route we're going to go, then everybody's all in. There is not one finger pointing. There is not, I told you so afterwards if the plan didn't work. Once we made a decision, then we go with it.
But did you ever wake up in a cold sweat in the middle of the night leading into that game going, what are we doing? We are absolutely objectively crazy.
No, yes, yeah, definitely. I mean, you think that I think the public will crucify you, you know, especially if you lose FAF early on. And that's what you think, you know. Remember, the team selection is for South Africa. It's never for us. It's never, and that's how we explain it to the players as well. Remember, we are selecting a team that's representing South Africa, 62 million people. And I promise you, you wake up at night with sweating, thinking, yes, if we lose FAF early on. I think in the Mombela game, FAF got a head knock and concussed after, and Jaden then had to play the rest of the game. So you think, yes, what if that happens? And now Cheslin has to go and play at scrum, but which we used him at training there a lot. So it's not for the fan, it looks maybe, yes, what are you doing? But he's been training there like for 12 weeks, 16 weeks. He's been training there. Every now and then he gets a couple of reps at scrum off, you know. So it is not, for us, it's not wasn't a weird idea. But you still think, listen, that might, if you lose the game, people will always say, listen, it's because you were too clever. You didn't have a specialist scrum off.
Jock, I had an extraordinary thing happen to me. So I was doing some work in America, in Dallas actually, and it was the week before the Texas Rangers won the World Series, and they'd never won it. And I listened to these baseball guys talking about coaching in the background, and the one guy was a statistician who'd converted, and he was a coach, and he was the most vociferous. He said, "It's not about the stats; it's about the battle." But obviously from a background of stats, you know, so he's like, I live in the world of stats. So it's not. And then they had, I've got it on here, and they gave away these bands where battle is written on the players. And they were like, you could walk into the World Series final, World Cup final, doesn't matter, with all the best stats in the whole world, but it's how you battle to make those stats happen. And then I got back and we were preparing for the World Cup, and you guys came out and actually put that moniker, the name Battle Stats, around the individual players or whatever, and I put battle and stats together. I was the happiest guy in the whole world because I'd seen it. I said that was a premonition for me, you know, and so wore it all the way through to the World Cup
well
final.
So Bob actually won you the World Cup, just so you know.
The opposite.
But talk to us about that battle stats, because there was a clip that came out, and I don't know if it's only in the South African algorithm that this thing floated around, where Nick Mallett speaks about you guys coming in to speak to the South African rugby commentators at some point and explaining how you measure battle stats stats, and that Quagga Smith was the guy who led on battle stats at that stage far and wide, and he had these insane numbers. For people who have no recollection of what I'm talking about here, could you break it down quickly?
Yeah, so the whole concept is probably... We always say that, listen, we much rather select. It comes down to team selection. So it's actually in our team selection protocol, we talk about battles. And we say that we will much rather select a player that get himself into 100 battles and he only wins 80% of them. So let's say he loses 20% of those battles. But so they will, in 80 battles, he will have an influence in the game. We would much rather select a guy like that than a guy who wins 100% of his battles, but he only gets himself in 40 battles. So it actually works. So basically it comes down to work rate. We'll much rather select a guy with a higher work rate than a guy that's more effective in his work, because we believe that we can get a guy through coaching, we can get him to be more effective. So we had two. We had battles and we had roadmaps. Roadmaps is actually how effective you are in your battles. So we actually just measure how much time you get yourself in a battle per minute of game time. So how quickly can you get yourself in a battle? So Quagga was, when we spoke to the Nick and Joel and the pundits in South Africa, just to give them a little bit of a backdrop of how we do team selection, what is our team selection policy, we explained battles right to them. Yeah.
And then Jock, I think one of the things that's been happening as well is off the back of that is understanding the pure performances, individual performances, which also affected the tournament. And for me, a standout was Peter Steff, you know, with the number of tackles he made. I mean, he had carries and line-out wins, etc. But in the World Cup final, you know, in an 80-minute game, you guys had 38 and a half minutes of ball in play. During that time, he was able to make 29 tackles. I think four of them were turnover, 12 of them were effective or something like that. But you talk about in the game and winning battle, the Malmesbury missile came good for South Africa in those 80 minutes.
No, he was phenomenal in the final. But I must say, Peter Steff, he in the World Cup, he just grew and grew and grew. I mean, we all know, I mean, he was World Player of the Year in 2019. So he's a phenomenal rugby player, but he just grew and grew and grew in the World Cup, and he became better and better and better. Him and Franco Mostert, those two guys, they can run for days.
Yeah.
For days.
Unbelievable athletes.
So I think, even Franco in the last three games in the knockouts, I don't think he missed a tackle.
Wow.
He was phenomenal defensively, and Peter Steff. So the two of them, not that the other guys are not, but their main thing is they just cover holes. If you look at what Peter Steff did in that in the final, I mean, how many times he's been on the first receiver of New Zealand, putting him under pressure. I mean, he's phenomenal at that.
Yeah, just runs towards suffering the whole time.
Yeah.
Is there something that you are proudest of? I'm guessing having two Rugby World Cup winners' medals, you know, like, I don't even know where are you hanging those in your new Leinster house? Are they close to the front door somewhere, or do
He's
you just keep them in the drawer?
Waiting for some decorators to arrive.
Yeah.
No, they are those medals are actually they in my home in Cape Town.
You left them in South Africa.
Yeah, I left them in South Africa.
They broke into SA Rugby the other day.
Yeah, I know. Medals come and go. It's the memories that last. And that's probably the big thing. I would say that the most enjoyable thing for me, Alma, is probably the memories you make. And I know it's a cliche thing, but the memories you make with players. I remember myself and Bob having a beer in Auckland at the pub. I think you phoned me and said, listen, are you keen on a beer? I remember that. I can't remember the games. I can't remember what the scores were. I don't remember that. But I remember the special little things that you make with the players. And I think for me, this group of players that now went to this World Cup, a lot of them, like Sia, I started coaching when he was 19. He was in the Western Province Academy. RG, I started coaching at SA Schools. I was fortunate enough to be involved SA Schools, SA Under 20. Andre Estreisen, Jesse, Thomas de Toy, the Priya brothers, they were both in the 2014 junior Springbok group. So, and you know what? The best thing about these players, you know, Sia hasn't changed. He never became the title. So Sia is Sia Kulisi, and then you get Sia, the Springbok rugby player and the World Cup winning captain. Sia never became Sia, the Springbok World Cup winning captain. He always stayed Sia. Mm-hmm. So I think that's probably for me the nicest thing of you ask what's the best? What's the thing that I will always remember and cherish the most? Is that the players never became the titles. They always just stayed the guy that I knew. Dwayne Vermeulen. I've been working with Dwayne since 2006, 17 years. We've been working together, either me just being his physio or coaching him or being his defense coach and in management. And Dwayne just stayed Dwayne, you know. He stayed the guy that came from the Pumas to the Cheetahs, you know. He always stayed that guy. So the nice thing, I saw them when they were young. They were yukkerig, they were naughty, they weren't married. And then I saw them becoming, they married and they became fathers and wives, fathers to wives and husbands to wives and fathers to kids. So to see the growth of the players is probably the thing that will sit in my head when I'm old and gray and shaking there in front of the fire. That I'll remember that.
Well, at least whatever highlights are flickering on the screen, you will have been part of. So there's a fantastic story in there for you as well, Jock. Well done.
You have so much to be proud of. Now, I'm trying to put myself in your shoes. Here's a guy who has massively overshot his own ambitions. All he wanted to do was be the Cheetah's physio. And he's gone on and achieved these amazing highs in the world of rugby. You could, at this stage, probably walk into almost any coaching job. Now, I know you announced the move to Leinster pre-World Cup already, but even then, you're pretty hot property. You've coached in Ireland before. I've mentioned earlier, but those who know that Jock loves a little red wine. You could have gone to France. Let's just put this out there. They also make wine in Australia. What is it that made you return to Ireland?
Probably the first thing is why leave international rugby? And for me, I explained it the other day and that then I'll go on to why Leinster. So international rugby, like this World Cup, I was away from home. When I got back, I sat the Sunday after the trophy tour, I lit a fire and we started praying and my son was sitting there, we're having a beer. He said, you know that today is 6 months and one day that you've been away from Cape Town. And then that's the thing of international rugby. Yes, it's only 13 test matches, but you are never at home. So I think since 2018, we've only played in Cape Town a test match twice. One was England and the other one was Wales. I'm excluding the British and Irish Lions because we were in a bubble. But so the thing of international rugby, you're away for a long, long time. Where in club rugby, you play more games. So it's not only 13, it's 38. But like I'm sitting at home now. Where if it was international, I was probably in a hotel somewhere, either in South Africa or abroad. In the beginning of the year, we were sitting as a family and the kids actually said, you know, so whenever you my daughter will say, come and watch a netball game, please, Dad. Like, I can't, sorry, man, I still need to do this analysis. So at the end of the day, you start, for success, you need time. The currency that we pay in, as coaches are time. And you only got 20, I've only got 24 hours in a day. So, and I have to sleep and I have to maybe go for a jog and maybe have a glass of wine. So just to keep my own sanity. So where do you get the more time? You take it from your family because they're your bank. They give it to you because they love you. So So that is actually the chat we had as a family, and they just said, "Listen, I was literally thinking, I'm gonna lose them alive, you know, if I continue with international rugby." And that's why it's not that I don't like international rugby. It's not that I don't like the Springboks. It's just, listen, I need to recharge my family time and time with my family, and that's why I decided not to continue with international rugby, hence with the Springboks or any other team. And so, what I do like about international rugby is the challenge of the players, because they are the best of the best, you know. And for me, luckily, Stuart decided to move on to Racing, who was with Leinster, and the Leinster job came up. And for me, I think the nice challenge with Leinster is, I mean, you basically sit with the Irish international squad. So I think that the demands of performance would be as high as the demand of performance will be with an international job. And the demands and the challenges that the players will put on to you as a coach will be as high as an international team will put on any coach. So for me, it's probably worked out the best of the best, if I can put it like that. You still work with international quality players in an international environment, almost within the Leinster environment. They run a very high performance assist. I'm only here for a week, but they run a high performance environment there, and I get some family time. So yeah, that's the reason why I decided to get out of international rugby, and that's why I had this conversation with Rasi, with Saru early on, and explained to them this is the reason. And I was open and honest with when Leinster approached me, and that's why I'm with Leinster and looking forward to working with him.
Jacques, yeah. It sounds like again you've come up with a strategy where not only do all the ends get served, but everybody wins.
Yeah.
He's been thinking about it very deeply.
Typically Jacques, exactly. A serious amount of thought and strategy has gone into this. Is there anything always you just do off the cuff, or is everything a big strategy game? Like, I fear for you as a golfer.
No, everything is wealth. I'm an overthinker. My wife reminds me a lot. Listen, sometimes you must just go with things, but no, I'm not like that. I'm a complete overthinker of things. Yeah. Too much.
Well, I think South Africa is very fortunate to have had an overthinker of your caliber in that setup for as long as you were there. And I think Leinster is in for some great new heights. So there's a ton of close losses on their recent score sheet history, and so I'm sure they'll be happy to have the guy who's renowned for the 1 point wins, three of them on the trot, in make or break games. To have you in the fold must be a massive reassurance for them.
Yeah, I'm just starting out here. Like I said, it's going to be a nice challenge. Yeah, looking forward to it. And the challenge will be, I know it's gonna take time to get my thought process and how I see things to get it embedded in the players and to get it second nature. It will take time. The Leinster's a brainy bunch, so I hope they, and I believe they will cop on very quickly to it.
Brilliant.
Jacques, from my side, I mean, I think you've made some incredible points. It's fantastic to, I mean, I know this is through a screen. I look forward to catching up more now that you're up in the Northern Hemisphere. And if I could convey every single well done and pat on the back that I've been told to give you, I'd knock over the TV screen because everybody is so pumped up and well done for what you've done for the country. So a huge big thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Bob. Yeah, looking forward to being along with you. It would be lovely.
Good man.
Thank you, Jacques. I know your time at home is precious. Thanks, and you have a family, no doubt, who is waiting. And Chewbacca, the dog, the king of the household, demands attention. So we really appreciate your time. And we look forward to seeing the wild adventures you will no doubt still be going on and the impact that you will have on players far and wide.
Thanks, Elmer. Yeah, thanks for having me. It was a pleasure for me.
If you want your fix of Payne Hask and Tins, then make sure you subscribe to The Lock-In on Apple and Spotify podcast platforms. We've been the good, the bad, and the rugby brought to you by our friends at Continental Tires. Thank you so much to Bob Skinstad for joining us on this very special review pod. And the pod is brought to you by Continental Tires. It's produced by Folding Pocket Productions, and the man in charge today, as usual, Tom Edwards.
You've been listening to The Good, Yay, The Bad, and The Rugby, Oof, with Alex Payne, James Haskell, and Mike Tindall. Thanks for listening.